Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Stacy Waite. Stacy Waite is an associate professor of English at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and has published four collections of poems: Choke, Love Poem to Androgyny, The Lake Has No Saint, and Butch Geography. Waite's poems have appeared most recently in Pittsburgh Poetry Review, Cherry Tree, and Court Green. Waite's newest book is a mixed-genre text entitled Teaching Queer, Radical Possibilities for Writing and Knowing, published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. Hi, Stacy. How are you?
I'm doing really great. It's good to be here, Jan.
Yeah, we've missed you. You've been in Nebraska, and when we really want you to be here.
I love Pittsburgh. It still feels like my writerly home.
It is. Okay. So you're going to start with some poems?
I would be glad to.
Okay.
I'm going to start out with two poems that are written in the voice of me as a young child. It's called Self-Portrait 1984. Dad tells Mom I'll end up a dyke from playing ice hockey. And my brother tells me a dyke is a girl who likes other girls. And I don't like girls at all. They only play jump rope at recess. And Jackie Wellman smells like fruit every single day. Sometimes no one can keep my mom from crying. I think the frying pans get grease in her eyes when she cooks. So I always say, I don't like anything hot. It's okay to lie about food, I think. When I take my bike on the horse trails, there are towers that make sounds like a baby singing, but the babies are invisible. My dad says no one is invisible but God. Sometimes I pretend the barn is my house. Sometimes I take apart my bike and put it back together all morning. No one knows what I can do. If you won't tell, I'll jump no hands from the hayloft door. I made a house out of boxes in the woods. I could live there if I wanted, if I wasn't scared of the tree limbs snatching me up. My dad says trees are alive, and I think they just might do something bad if they could. And this is Self-Portrait 1986. I like to take my shirt off outside. I like lying bearskin, my back to the cooled, wet blacktop where my father has washed his vintage Chevy, the soap suds tingling my shoulder blades. I don't like the fourth grade one bit. I don't like my brothers, how they get to be boys, how they're allowed to jump from the hayloft door. I don't like when people say, little girl, or when we have to change in the locker room and get ready for girls' gym class, which is different from boys' gym class. I don't like watching the boys play crab soccer through the window. I don't like disco aerobics while I am watching the boys hold up their bodies on their hands. This church dress won't last. Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to ride my bike to the horse trails. I'm going to bury the dress out by the horse farm. I'm going to bury it so deep, the dogs can't even dig it up. Sometimes I can't keep promises. Sometimes I pack my flashlight and cereal and sneak out of the house at night. I have every intention of living in the woods. I breathe in the dark air. I pretend everyone is listening to what I want to say. I sing the Pet Shop Boys under the sycamore. Sometimes the world is too small for a kid like me. The Pet Shop Boys are from England. England is far, so far that if I could get to it, no one, not one single person, could find me. Not anyone. Not ever. All right, I'm doing a little change of pace here. This is another poem from Butch Geography called The Kind of Man I Am at the DMV. Mommy, that man is a girl, says The boy, pointing his finger like a narrow spotlight, targeting the center of my back, his kid hand learning to assert what he sees, his kid hand learning the failure of gender's tidy little story about itself. I try not to look at him because, yes, that man is a girl. I, man, am a girl. I am the kind of man who is a girl. And because the kind of man I am is patient with children, I try not to hear the meanness in his voice, his boy voice that sounds like a girl voice because his boy voice is young and pitched high, like the tent in his pants will be years later because he will grow to be the kind of man who is a man. Or so his mother thinks. His mother snatches his finger from the air. Of course he's not, she says, pulling him back to his seat. What number does it say we are? She says to her boy, bringing his attention back to numbers, to counting, and its solid sense. But he has earrings, the boy complains, now sounding desperate, like he's been the boy who cried wolf, like he's been the hub of disbelief before, but this time he knows he is, oh, so right. The kind of man I am is a girl. Kind of man I am is push-ups on the basement floor, is chest bound tight against himself, is thick gripping hands to the wheel when the kind of man I am drives away from the boy who will become a boy, except for now, while he's still a girl voice, a girl face, a hairless arm, a powerless hand. That boy is a girl. This man who is a girl thinks to himself as he pulls out of the lot, his girl eyes shining in the Midwest sun. So I'm going to read a couple of new poems. This one is called Mothers and Men. My mother never warned me of anything. Never said, watch out for boys who spit or curse or punch. Never said, look for signs that he needs to control you. Never said, boys will be boys. Never said, beware of the brute strength of big men. Maybe she knew I was one of them, that there was part of me that would not woman. But still, when I wander off into the woods with Joel at 12, and his tongue is rolling in my mouth like an avocado pit, and he pushes my head toward his belt buckle, then his whole hands grasping around the bone of my wrist, he stops the bulging tongue to say, I won't let you go until you do. I try to look past the brown glimmer of his eyes. He is smiling when he says it. We are the same height, Joel and I. Our jawlines lean and sharp, our eyebrows thick and wet from the heat. I recognize myself in him. I shove him, run barefoot through the woods, pine needles digging their needling ends into the bottoms of my feet. I feel the sting of who we might become, Joel and I. Two men in the woods, one of us a warning, the other a woman, a fleeing fire.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Stacy Waite, reading her poems. Stacy, I wanted to repeat a line from your poem, the DMV poem, Gender's Tidy Little Story About Itself, which seems to, like, bullseye, you know, your whole mission in your poetry. I guess, would you say that's true to blow that up?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not just like a aesthetic or poetic mission, but it's like my life mission to like make a mess out of things that are supposed to be easy or tidy or obvious. And I feel like both my teaching and my writing are an attempt to be like, hey, this isn't obvious. It's not even real. Right. And so I think that's part of the project of all of my poems, really, and also of, like, you know, what I hope to teach when I'm teaching poetry in terms of how poetry can kind of bring us to seeing what language makes of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you have some whole new manuscript of poems that you're working on, and you've read one, but you're going to read some more. Can you talk about that a little, that movement into these new poems, and do you see yourself making a new kind of mess in these poems, or continuing?
You know? I do. I mean, in some ways, I'm continuing. I feel like in the same way that I feel like all of us poets just continue with our various obsessions in new ways, with very few exception that I can think of. So, you know, and I've had times in my life where I've been like, Stacey, maybe you need to give up this writing about gender stuff. Why don't you sit down and write a poem about a tree? And then I'm like, that didn't work. Before you know it, the tree's getting phallic. I don't know what's happening. It's all about gender. So I know that is my part of my life's work, you know, and I know and I trust it to change. And I feel like the new work is really trying to think about masculinity. There's a series of poems in the new book that I actually didn't bring with me today, but in some ways, the poems I'm going to read are speaking to that series as well, which is called To the Men Who Think I'm One of Them. And I've just been thinking a lot lately about masculinity, about what permissions it gives me, what horrors I see when I'm let into the club of masculinity. And I wanted to write poems that tried to take some ownership of that, that it's not just men that do the damage of masculinity. And it's not that masculinity is inherently damaging or evil, but I really wanted to think about the work that masculinity does in the world and the way we could think more carefully about that. So I think this new work is really focused on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm looking forward to it. Can you read some more?
I can. Okay, so this is a poem from that new manuscript. This poem's called The Four Nights She's Gone. One. The news says two rapists escape from the state penitentiary. Your friend's husband comes over for dinner. He teaches your son to jump the sprinkler in the yard. You drink gin on the back steps, talk like two men do. He eats spaghetti at your table, the light settling behind the trees. He stays when your son begs for a movie, and the three of you stretch out on the couch, the TV fervent with little penguins. Your son touches his beard. You want him to spend the night, to stand watch at the door in shifts with you, like soldiers. You talk yourself down. The rapists won't come here. You took 13 years of martial arts. You know how to kill a man. They might not even be rapists. You do not ask him to stay. You hear the helicopters overhead, their lights scanning the neighborhood. You scold yourself as you put your son to bed. What kind of man are you? Maybe your son does need a father if you are scared of a little town jailbreak. You sing to him the same song your mother sung to you. You wonder what song a real man would sing, or if the kind of man who guards the door would sing at all. 2. You find out an alligator has snatched a 2-year-old boy from a lagoon. They say his father fought the alligator for his boy. They say this time of year is nesting season for the alligator, guarding her young, protecting the perimeter of her 90 eggs, which she listens to intently until she hears a high pitch of noise coming from the eggs, which signals she should uncover the nest. You imagine yourself fighting the alligator, your fists bloody with the scrape of her claws, which, they say, are considered lucky for gamblers. You imagine you are able to kill the alligator, that your rage is too great, even for a 500-pound reptile mother. You close your eyes. You see yourself carrying your son from the water, the alligator floating at the edge, dead instead of your son. Her young, left to be born lost. This is what we do. Imagine our strength more holy, our rage more pure, our love some otherworldly force impossible to contain, dangerous and beyond measure. 3. The neighborhood, too quiet. Its breath sucked into summer heat. Your son, asleep too easily, doesn't even call you back. Doesn't plea for one more song at the edge of his bed. You sit still in a kitchen chair, planted like a pushpin, staring into half-eaten dinner. You don't clean the dishes. You don't make his lunch. You don't write anything down. You sit perfectly still, like a child who thinks, if I don't move, then no one can see me. 4. You fall asleep on the couch as you sometimes do when she's out of town. 2 a.m., the air conditioning quits on you. The neighbor's dog barking at its back gate. You wake up sweating. You pull the steak knife from under the couch. You've been carrying it from room to room. You think to yourself, a real man would have a gun. This night in Orlando, there is a real man with a real gun who has just begun shooting in a nightclub, on a dance floor, in a bathroom, presumably protecting whatever it is he sees fit to defend. But it turns out, in the end, not everything broken in him, in us, is worth saving.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Stacy Waite. And it's such a powerful poem. And it seems to me the voice in your work is so distilled and so clear, and it seems to me like more so than ever. And as if the voice is coming forward, being more overtly political than before. Would you say that's accurate?
Probably. I mean, I feel that it's almost like the conditions of your life, I feel like, sometimes can propel the conditions of your aesthetic. And the conditions of my life are such now that I don't have time not to be clear. Here it is. This is as clear as I can get it. You know, it feels like both in my personal life and in the political climate in which we live, there's a kind of urgency to say it and say it now. And I think that's where I feel like I'm at with my work is like no time to mess around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's coming across.
Well, that's good, I guess. I hope.
But I also wanted to mention those moments in your poems that it's almost like everything else falls away and the voice just is there, like in a number of your poems, but in this last one, This Is What We Do, you know, those moments. And in earlier poems you read, no one knows what I can do. I love that line. That's a great one. But I love when those lines just rise up and it's almost like the poem drops in a way.
Yeah, you know, I love those moments in other people's poems. When I was in graduate school some years ago now, I started reading the poet Ralph Angel, who, if you would guess that he would be a poet I would love, you wouldn't necessarily. But he had this way of grounding and then just saying the thing. He has this poem called Love's That Simple, and the last lines are, we either forgive one another who we really are or not. And there's a line break there. And I remember reading those poems and going, if I could just write good enough to get away with saying that, something that true, mm-hmm. You know? And I guess I'm trying.
Yeah, I guess that's it. Well, I remember years ago you talking about Ralph Angel, and here you are with these lines. That's great. Okay, we have time for more.
So I'm actually going to read a little bit from my newest book, which is called Teaching Queer. It has some poetry vignettes inside of it, and so I'm going to share a few of those. Imagining a future for me has always been about imagining other worlds, other ways of being outside the ones I had always known. I remember in 1986, when Halley's Comet was about to rise over Long Island sometime around 3 a.m. I was 9 years old, and my mother, against my father's wishes, snuck me out of bed. It was March, so not quite cold, but not quite warm. And my mother watches from the window, dozes off from time to time as I lay on the cool blacktop of the driveway and wait with my cheap grade school telescope to see something fleeting, unknowable, to see something that I knew I might only see once. I never did find the comet that night, but it mattered less that I saw it and more that I imagined doing so. It mattered more that I was up past my bedtime, looking out at a world I knew was beyond my understanding or grasp, wondering about what might be possible. My third grade teacher, Mr. Shellhorn, took us on frequent field trips. And there are some parts of field trips I hate. The bus rides, the lining up, the public bathrooms of visitors' centers and rest stops. For one trip, we visit the Long Island Central Pine Barrens. I'm fascinated by the nearly 100,000 acres of plant life said to be growing on infertile soil. I'm obsessed with telling my parents after the trip, the Pine Barrens need to burn in brush fires to survive. Did you know that? They need to burn to survive. The idea that sometimes something needs to burn in order to live really appeals to me. Mr. Shellhorn walks me through the woods along the Peconic River. He tells me this is really the last part of Long Island that is truly wilderness. Everything else is kept in order by landscapers, he says. What I remember perhaps most vividly about third grade was leaving Mr. Shellhorn's classroom on the last day of school, turning to look at the room as I made my way down the hall. The place was a mess, unsafe even. Scissors everywhere, dead insects scattered around the microscope, wet paintings hanging in the coat closet. By some measure, he was a terrible teacher. Disorganized, partial to particular kinds of misfit students, prone to letting the room get out of control, as I have heard my father put it. But it was in that room I learned that the weird stuff I wrote counted for something, and that writing did save Wilbur in Charlotte's Web, even if it can't save all of us. We can at least still teach like it could. She's talking like her brothers on purpose, my father says, when he is trying to convince my stepmother that the depth of my voice is not inherent in my voice itself. There's too many men around, he says, and this is without knowing about the hockey boys, the hockey coach, the weekend trips to the batting cages, the neighbor boy's barn where I had jumped time and time again from the hayloft door. They sit me down, as parents call it. My stepmother teaches me to lift my voice, to let more air into the words. I try not to answer the phone, to get mistaken for one of my brothers or worse, my father. At night, I have dreams that my voice box is made of ink, that when it runs out, I won't be able to say another word. There is, in the end, something inevitably quiet about where I live now. Its endless stretch of sky, the silent vulnerability of standing underneath it. It's hard not to think I'm meant also to quiet down, to shed the skin made of noise, to pull the sound out from my throat, let it fall silent at my feet. Quiet down now, was what my father used to say when we had crossed the threshold of his short fuse. Quiet down, as in make your father a moment of peace, as in leave him some room to think for once. But what my father found when my brothers and I fell silent in the back seat, was nothing but the open road, nothing but the car engine, the world gone so quiet he could hear his eyelids touch when he blinked. All the children are laughing. The two first graders, Lucy Cavaro and Craig Larson, they each have rocks. Lucy is taunting, "Are you a boy or a girl? Boy or a girl?" I don't say anything. I keep doing what I do whenever I feel cornered like this. I look off through the green fence and picture myself as capable of movement. I picture myself faster than I am, as fast as a boy, I suppose. I see myself leap the tire swing and head for home, but Lucy won't quit. She hurls one of her rocks at my feet. "Can't you even talk?" she wants to know. I can't rid myself of the fire rising in my small round belly. There's a pasty coating on my tongue, and the lump in my throat is growing, expanding like a party balloon. I can't breathe. When Miss Sherry finds us, she's angry. When I tell her Lucy does this to me, she wants to know why I don't answer. "Tell her you're a girl," she says. But I can't think of what to tell, the way I can't think of any sins to tell the priest at confession. I saw a face of contradiction. I was frozen, unnamed, on a playground. My relatives were always trying to give me my gender in the form of dollhouses, Hello Kitty blankets, pink things, yellow things, Barbies, the beloved in the 80s Cabbage Patch dolls. I wanted them to give me another version of gender, and sometimes, usually in private, someone would. My mother, a batting glove. My grandfather, a baseball hat. My brother, advice. "This is how you punch back," he says. "Right, like this. This is how."
The writing of Stacy Waite. Thank you so much. That was beautiful.
Thank you so much. It was such a delight to be here.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty, our sound engineers by Lisa Alexander and Michelle Stoner. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.